just a skinny little boy in grimy underpants. He started for the door, then turned back. Audrey herself was still on her knees, trying to decide if she could reach out for the counter from where she was, or if she should crawl a little closer first. She cringed at first when she saw him coming back, thinking that Tak had returned, thinking she saw the hard shine of its intelligence in Seth's eyes. When he got closer, she saw that she had made a natural enough mistake. Seth was crying. She had never seen him cry before, not even when he came to her with scraped knees or a banged head. Until now, she hadn't been entirely sure he could. He put his arms around her neck and dropped his forehead against hers. It hurt, but she didn't draw away. For a moment, she had a blurred but very emphatic image of the red telephone, only grown to enormous size. Then it was gone, and she heard Seth's voice in her head. She'd thought on several occasions that she was hearing him, that he was trying to contact her telepathically. It was always distant, like a voice calling through blankets of fog. Now, however, it was shockingly close. It was the voice of a child, who sounded not in the least defective.
"I don't blame you for trying to run," the voice said.
Audrey had a sense of hurry and furtiveness. It was like listening to a kid whisper some vital piece of classroom gossip to his seatmate while the teacher's back is briefly turned.
"Get to the others. The ones across the street. You have to wait, but it won't be long because he's..."
No words. But another blurred image that filled her head completely, temporarily driving out all thought. It was Seth. He was dressed in jester's motley and a cap of bells. He was juggling, not balls, dolls, little china ones, Hummel figures. But until he dropped one and it shattered and she saw the broken face of Mary Jackson lying beside one of the jester's red and white curly-toed slippers, she did not realize that the dolls were her neighbors. She supposed she was responsible for at least some of that image. She had seen Kirsty Carver's Hummel figures 1,000 times. But she understood that whatever she might have added didn't in the least change what Seth was trying to convey. Whatever craziness Tak was up to, his building, his making, it was keeping him very busy. "Not too busy to see me when I broke for the door a few minutes ago," she thought. "Not too busy to stop me, not too busy to punish me either. Maybe next time it'll be salt going down my throat instead of honey. Or drain cleaner."
"I'll tell you when,"
the child's voice returned.
"Listen for me, Aunt Audrey. After the power wagons come again, listen for me. It's important that you get away because..."
This time many images flickered past. An empty Chef Boyardee can lying in the trash, an old broken toilet lying on its side in the dump, a car up on blocks, no wheels, no glass. Things that were broken, things that were used up. The last thing she saw before he broke contact was the studio portrait of herself on the table in the front hall. The eyes of the portrait were gouged out. Seth released her and stood back, watching as she grasped the edge of the counter and struggled to her feet. Her belly, heavy and thick with the honey Tak had made her swallow, felt like a counterweight.
"Ah, oh,"
he said in his toneless voice, sounding she and Herb had speculated might mean "Audrey, hello," and then walked out of the kitchen. Back to the den, where the climactic shootout was still going on. And when it was done, why, rewind the FBI warning and start all over again, most likely.
"But he talked to me," she thought, "out loud and inside my head, on his version of the play school phone. Only his version is so big."
She took the broom from its place in the pantry alcove and began to sweep up spilled flour and macaroni. In the den, Rory Calhoun yelled,
"You ain't going nowhere, you sow-bellied Yankee."
"Doesn't have to be this way, Jeb," Audrey murmured, sweeping.
"It doesn't have to be this way, Jeb,"
Ty Harden, Deputy Lane in the movie, said, and then bad old Colonel Murdoch shot him. His final act of villainy. In another 30 seconds, he would be shot dead himself. Audrey's diaphragm knotted again, hard. She went to the sink, trailing the broom in one hand, and bent over. A moment later, the clench subsided. She turned on the cold water tap, leaned over, drank directly from the faucet, then gingerly splashed a couple of handfuls on her throbbing forehead. It felt good. Wonderful. Talk was building, Seth had said. But what? As she dropped awkwardly to her knees by her pile of sweepings, the broom in one hand and the dustpan in the other, a more urgent question occurred to her. If she did get away, what would it do to Seth? Belinda Josephson held the kitchen door for her husband, then straightened up and looked around. The overhead light wasn't on, but the room was still a little brighter than it had been. The storm was slackening, and she supposed that in another hour or two it would be hot and bright again. She looked at the wall clock over the kitchen table, and she felt a mild burst of unreality. 4:03? Was it possible so little time had gone by? She took a closer look, and saw that the second hand wasn't moving. She reached for a light switch beside the door as Johnny crawled into the kitchen on his hands and knees and then stood up. "Don't bother," Jim Reed said. He was sitting on the floor between the fridge and the stove, with Ralphie Carver on his lap. Ralphie's thumb was in his mouth. His eyes were glazed and apathetic. "Power's off." There were a lot of people in this room. She made it 11, counting herself. But the numb silence which had settled over them made it seem like less. Ellie Carver was still giving an occasional watery gasp, but her face was against her mother's breast, and Belinda thought she might actually be asleep. David Reed had his arm around Susie Geller. Sitting on the girl's other side, also with an arm around her, was her mother. Cammie Reed, the twins' mother, was sitting against a door with a sign on it reading, "Ye Old Pantry." Belinda didn't think Cammie was quite as out of it as some of the others. Her eyes had a cool, thoughtful look. "You said you heard screaming?" Johnny said to Susie. "It's over," the girl said dully. "I think maybe it was Mrs. Soderson." "Sure it was," Jim said. He shifted Ralphie on his lap, wincing a little as he did. "I recognized it. We've been listening to her scream at Gary for most of our lives, haven't we, Dave?" Dave Reed nodded. "I'd have murdered her by now, honest." "Ah, but you don't imbibe, my boy," Johnny said in his best W.C. Fields voice. He took the kitchen phone out of its cradle, listened, bopped the zero button a couple of times, then hung up.
"Debbie's dead, isn't she?" Susie asked Belinda. "She didn't go over next door at all." "Don't lie." Belinda thought about doing just that, but it didn't seem the right way to go on somehow. In her experience, even well-intentioned lies usually made things worse, more crazy. Belinda thought things were crazy enough on Poplar Street already. "Yes, honey," she said, marveling at how southern she always sounded when she had to give someone bad news. What made it particularly interesting in her case was that she had never been south of the Mason-Dixon line in her whole life. "Yes, honey, I'm afraid she is." Susie put her hands over her face and began to sob. Dave Reed pulled her to him, and Susie put her face against his shoulder. When Kim tried to pull her back, Susie stiffened her body and resisted. Her mother gave Dave Reed a dirty look, which the boy missed entirely. She turned her angry face to Belinda instead. "Why did you tell her that?" "Girl's lying right out there on the stoop, and with all that red hair, she's kind of hard to miss." There was a screened window behind the sink. Looking through it to the right, she could see the stake fence separating the Carver's plot from old Doc's. She could also see the green roof of the Billingsley house. Above it, the clouds already appeared to be unraveling. She turned and boosted herself, sitting side-saddle on the edge of the sink. Then she leaned close to the screen, smelling its metal and all the wet summer straining through its mesh.
The combined aroma called up a momentary nostalgia for her childhood, a feeling that was both fine and fierce. It was strange, she thought, how it was almost always the smells of things that took you back the hardest.
"Hello?"
she called, cupping her hands around her mouth. Brad grabbed her shoulder, apparently wanting her to stop, and she shook him off emphatically.
"Hello? Billingsley?"
"Don't do that, Bee," Cammy Reed said. "It's not wise." And what would be wise, Belinda thought, just sitting on the kitchen floor and waiting for the cavalry to come? "Hell, go on," Johnny said. "What harm can it do? If the people who did the shooting are still around, I imagine that where we are is hardly a big secret to them." An idea seemed to strike him at that, and he dropped on his hunkers in front of the late postman's wife. "Kirsten, did David have a gun?" "There's a pistol in his desk," she said. "In his little office, upstairs, the end of the hall." She said all this while seeming to contemplate her own knees, then raised desperate, distracted eyes to look at him. "He's out in the rain, Johnny. So's Susie's friend. We shouldn't leave them out in the rain." "It's stopping," Johnny said, and his face suggested he knew how inane that sounded. It seemed to satisfy Pi, though, and Belinda supposed that was the important thing. "Just take care of your kids, Kirsty, and don't concern yourself with the rest of it for the time being." He got up and started for the swinging door, walking in a battlefield crouch. "Mr. Marinville?" Jim Reed asked. "Can I come with you?" But when he attempted to set Ralphie aside, a panicked look came into the boy's eyes. He clung to Jim, muttering, "No, no, no, Jim," under his breath, in a way that made Belinda feel like shivering. She thought mad people probably talked that way when they were alone in their cells at night. "Stay where you are, Jim," Johnny said. "Brad, what about you? Little trip to higher altitudes?"
"Sure."
Brad looked at his wife with that expression of love and exasperation that is the sole property of people who have been married over 10 years. "You really think it's okay for this woman of mine to be shooting off her mouth? I repeat, what harm can it do?"
"Be careful," Belinda said.
She smoothed a hand briefly across Brad's chest.
"Keep your head down. Promise me."
"I promise to keep my head down."
She looked at Johnny.
"Now you."
"Huh? Oh." He offered a charming grin, and Belinda had a sudden insight. That was the way Johnny Marinville always grinned when he made promises to women.
"I promise."
They went out, dropping a little self-consciously to their knees as they passed through the swinging door and into the Carver's front hall. Belinda leaned toward the screen again. Besides rain and wet grass, she could smell the old Hobart place burning. The downpour would probably keep the fire from spreading, but where were the fire trucks?
"Hello? Billingsley's?"
After a moment, a man's voice called back.
"There are 7 of us. The couple from up the block."
That had to be the Soddersons, Belinda thought.
"Plus the cop and the guy married to the dead woman. There's also Mr. Billingsley and Cynthia from the store."
"Who are you?"
Belinda called.
"Steve Ames. I'm from New York. I was having trouble with my truck, pulled off the interstate, got lost. I stopped at the store down there to use the phone."
"Poor guy," Dave Reed said. "Like winning the lottery in hell."
"What's going on?"
the voice from the other side of the fence called.
"Do you know?"
"No,"
Belinda shouted back. She thought furiously. There must be more to say, other things to ask. But she couldn't think of anything at all.
"Have you looked up the street? Is it clear?"
Ames called. Belinda opened her mouth to reply and then was distracted momentarily by the spider's web outside the screen. The window's overhang had protected it from the worst of the squall, but raindrops hung from the gossamer threads like tiny quivering diamonds. The owner-operator was at the center of the web, not moving, maybe dead.
"Ma'am?" I asked. "I don't know," she called back. "Johnny Marinville and my husband looked, but now they've gone upstairs to..."
She didn't want to mention the gun. Stupid, maybe, rat-hole thinking, but it didn't change the way she felt.
To get a better look. What about you? It's been pretty busy here, ma'am. The woman from up the block.
A pause.
Does your phone work?
No,
Belinda called.
No phone, no electric.
Another pause. Then lower, barely audible over the diminishing hiss of the rain, she heard him say,
Shit.
Then there was another voice, one she knew but couldn't immediately place. Belinda, is that you?
Yes,
she returned, and looked around at the others for help. It's Mr. Jackson, Jim Reed said, speaking around Ralphie's shoulder.
I've been out to the front door, Peter called. The street's deserted all the way down to the corner, completely deserted. No gawkers or rubberneckers from Hyacinth or the next block of Poplar. Does that make any sense to you?
Belinda thought, frowning, then looked around. She saw only puzzled eyes and dropped heads. She turned back to the window.
No.
Peter laughed. The sound chilled her the way little Ralphie Carver's distraught muttering had chilled her. Who'd come on the block? Kim Geller scoffed. Who in their right minds, with guns going off and people screaming and everything? Belinda didn't know how to respond to that. It was logical, but it still didn't hold water. Because people didn't behave logically when trouble broke out. They came and they gawked.
Are you sure there aren't people down below the corner?
She called. This time the pause was so long she was about to repeat the question when a third voice spoke up. She had no trouble recognizing old Doc.
None of us sees anyone, but the rain has started to mist off the pavement. Until it clears, we can't tell for sure.
But there are no sirens.
Peter again.
Do you hear any coming from the north?
No,
she returned.
It must be the storm.
I don't think so, Cammy Reed said. She spoke for herself, to herself, not the group. If the old pantry hadn't been in close proximity to the sink, Belinda wouldn't have heard her. Nope, I don't think so at all.
I'm going out to get my wife,
Peter Jackson called. Other voices were immediately raised in protest against this idea. Belinda couldn't make out the words, but the emotional tone was unmistakable. Suddenly the spider, the one she had assumed was dead, scuttered from the center of its web and, mounting one of the silk strands, scrambled up until it had disappeared under the eave. Not dead after all, Belinda thought. Only playing possum. Then Kirsten Carver was leaning past her, bumping Belinda so hard with her shoulder that Belinda would have gone ass deep into the sink if she hadn't managed to grab the corner of an overhead cabinet. Pye's face was parchment pale, her eyes blazing with fear.
Don't you go out there, she screamed. They'll come back and kill you. They'll come back and kill all of us.
No answer from the other house for several moments, and then Collie and Trajan spoke up in a voice that sounded both apologetic and bemused. No good, ma'am. He's gone.
You should have stopped him,
Kirsten screamed. Belinda put an arm around the woman's shoulder and was frightened by the steady high vibration she felt, as if Kirsten was on the verge of exploding.
What kind of policeman are you?
He's not, Kim said. She spoke in a just-what-the-hell-did-you-expect tone. He got kicked off the force. He was running a hot car ring. Susie raised her head. I don't believe it.
What do you know about it, a girl your age?
Her mother asked. Belinda was about to slide off the edge of the sink when she saw something on the back lawn that made her freeze. It was caught against one leg of the kid's swing set, and like the spider web, jeweled with hanging drops of rain. Cammy?
What?
Come here. If anyone would know, Cammy would. She had a garden in her backyard, a jungle of potted plants inside her house, and a library's worth of books on growing things. Cammy got up from her place by the pantry door and came over. Susie and her mother joined her. So did Dave Reed. Look over there, by the swings. What do you see? Cammy started to say she didn't. Then Belinda pointed, and she did. Thunder mumbled to the east of them, and the breeze kicked up a brief gust. The thing Belinda had seen got free of the swing set and rolled partway across the carver's backyard, in the direction of the stake fence. "That's impossible," Cammy said flatly. "Russian thistle doesn't grow in Ohio. Even if it did, this is summer. They root in summer." "What's Russian thistle, Mom?" Dave asked. His arm was around Susie's waist. "I never heard of it." "Tumbleweed," Cammy said in that same flat voice. "Russian thistle is tumbleweed." Johnny looked into the chambers of David Carver's pistol one more time, as if a bullet might have grown in one of them while he wasn't looking, then snapped the cylinder back into place. He stuck the pistol in his belt and tucked the box of cartridges into his shirt pocket. The front hall was a minefield of Ralphie Carver's boy toys. The kid had apparently not been introduced by his doting parents to the concept of picking up after himself. Brad went into what had to be the little girl's bedroom. Johnny followed him. Brad pointed out the window. Peter Jackson was on Doc's lawn, kneeling beside his wife. He had gotten her into a sitting position again. One arm was around her back. He was working the other under her cocked knees. Her skirt was well up on her thighs, and Johnny thought again about her missing pants. Well, so what? So fucking what? Johnny could see the man's back shaking as sobs racked him. Silver light ran across the top of his vision. He looked up and saw what looked like an old Airstream trailer, or maybe a lunch wagon, turning left onto Poplar from Hyacinth. Close behind it was the red van that had taken care of the dog and the paper boy, and behind that was the one with the dark blue metal flake paint. He looked the other way, up toward Bear Street, and saw the van with the Mary Kay paint job and the Valentine radar dish, the yellow one that had first rear-ended Mary and then rode her off the street, and the black one with the turret. Six of them, in two converging lines of three. He had seen American LAC vehicles in the same formation a long time ago in Vietnam. They were creating a fire corridor. For a moment he couldn't move. "You can't," he thought with a kind of sick, unbelieving fury. "You can't come back, you bastards." Brad didn't see them. He was looking at the man on the lawn of the house next door, absorbed in Peter's effort to get up with his wife's dead weight in his arms. And Peter, Johnny got his right hand moving. He wanted it to streak. It seemed to float instead. He got it around the handle of the gun and pulled it out of the waistband of his pants. Couldn't shoot it. No loads in the chamber. Couldn't load it either, not in his current state. So he brought it down butt first, shattering the glass of Ellen's bedroom window. "Get inside!" he screamed at Peter, and his voice came out sounding low and strengthless to his own ears. Dear God, what nightmare was this, and how had they stumbled into it? "Get inside! They're coming again! They're back!" Poplar Street, 4:44 p.m., July 15, 1996. They seemed to come out of the mist rising off the street. Windows slide down. The porthole on the flank of the pink dream floater Iris is open again. The windshield of Bounty's blue freedom van retracts into a smooth darkness from which three grayish shotgun barrels bristle. Thunder rumbles, and somewhere a bird cries harshly. There is a beat of silence, and then the shooting begins. It's like the thunderstorm all over again, only worse, because this time it's personal, and the guns are louder than before. Collie and Trajan, lying face down in the doorway between Billingsley's kitchen and living room, is the first to notice this, but the others are not long in realizing it for themselves. Each shot is almost like a grenade blast, and each is followed by a low, moaning sound, something caught between a buzz and a whistle. Two shots from the red tracker arrow, and the top of Collie and Trajan's chimney is nothing but maroon dust in the wind, and pebble-sized chunks of brick pattering down on his roof. A shot strikes the plastic spread over Carrie Ripton, making it ripple like a parachute, and another tears off the rear wheel of his bike. Ahead of Tracker Arrow is the silver van that looks like an old-fashioned lunch wagon. Part of its roof rises at an angle, and a silver figure, it appears to be a robot in a Confederate infantryman's uniform, leans out. It mails 3 shotgun rounds special express into the burning Hobart house. Each report seems as loud as a dynamite blast. Coming downhill from Bear Street, Dream Floater and the Justice Wagon pour fire into 251 and 249, the Josephson House and the Soderson House. The windows blow in. The doors blow open. A round that sounds like something thrown from a small anti-aircraft gun hits the back of Gary's old Saab. The back end crumples in, shards of red taillight glass fly, and there's a whoomp as the gas tank explodes, engulfing the little car in a ball of smoky orange flame. The south-moving trio of vans and the trio moving north meet, cross, and stop in front of the stake fences separating the Billingsley place from the Carver house above it and the Jackson house below it. Audrey Weiler, who was eating a sandwich and drinking a can of light beer in the kitchen when the shooting started, stands in the living room, staring out at the street with wide eyes, unaware that she's still holding half of a salami and lettuce on rye in one hand. The firing has merged into one continuous, ear-splitting World War III roar, but she is in no danger. All of it is currently being directed at the 2 houses across from her. She sees Ralphie Carver's red wagon, Buster, rise into the air with one side blown into a twisted metal flower. It cartwheels over David Carver's soggy corpse, lands with its wheels up and spinning, and then another hit bends it almost double and sends it into the flowers to the left of the driveway. Another round blows the Carver screen door off its hinges and hammers it down the hall. 2 more from Bounty's Freedom van vaporize most of Pye's prized Hummel figures. Holes open in the crushed back deck of Mary Jackson's Lumina, and then it too explodes, flames belching up and swallowing the car back to front. Bullets tear off 2 of old Doc's shutters. A hole the size of a baseball appears in the mailbox mounted beside his door. The box drops to the welcome mat, smoking. Another kabam, and the bungalow's door knocker, a silver St. Bernard's head, disappears. Seeming oblivious of all this, Peter Jackson struggles to his feet with his dead wife in his arms. His round, rimless glasses, the lenses spotted with water, glint in the strengthening light. His pale face is the face of a man whose entire bank of fuses has burnt out. But he's standing there, miraculously whole. Miraculously. Aunt Audrey. Seth. Very faint, but definitely Seth. Aunt Audrey, can you hear me? Yes, Seth, what's happening? Never mind. The voice sounds on the edge of panic. You have the place to go to, don't you? The safe place? Mohonk? Did he mean Mohonk? He must, she decided. Yes, I... Go there! The faint voice cries, go there now, because... The voice doesn't finish and doesn't have to. She has turned away from the furious shooting gallery in the street, turned toward the den, where the movie, is playing again. The volume has been cranked, somehow far beyond what their zenith should be able to produce. Seth's shadow bounces ecstatically up and down on the wall, elongated and somehow horrible. It's as if Tuck is twisting inside the child's body, warping it, stretching it, driving it ruthlessly beyond its ordinary limits and boundaries. Nor is that all that's happening. She turns back to the window, stares out. At first she thinks it's her eyes, something wrong with her eyes. Perhaps Tuck has melted them somehow, but she holds her hands up in front of her and they look all right. No, it's Poplar Street that's wrong. It seems to be twisting out of perspective in some way she can't quite define. Angles changing, corners bulging, colors blurring. It's as if reality is on the verge of liquefying, and she thinks she knows why. Tuck's long period of preparation and quiet growth is over. The time of action has come. Tuck is making. TikTok is building. Seth told her to get out, at least for a while. But where can Seth go? Seth? She tries, concentrating as hard as she can. Seth, come with me.
I can't. Go, Aunt Audrey. Go now.
The agony in that voice is more than she can endure. She turns toward the arch again, the one which leads into the den, but sees a meadow slanting down to a rock wall instead. There are wild roses. She smells them and feels the sexy, delicate heat of spring now tending toward summer. And then Janice is beside her, and Janice is asking her what her all-time favorite Simon and Garfunkel song is. In the Carver kitchen, the refugees lie with their hands laced over the backs of their heads and their faces pressed to the floor. Around them, glass shatters, furniture falls, something explodes. There are horrible punching sounds as bullets pound through the walls. Suddenly, Pie Carver can stand Ellie's clinging to her no more. She loves Ellen, of course she does, but it's Ralphie she wants now, and Ralphie she must have. Smart, sassy Ralphie, who looks so much like his father. She pushes Ellen roughly away, ignoring the girl's cry of startled dismay, and bolts for the niche between the stove and the fridge, where Jim is hunched over the frantic, screaming Ralphie, holding one hand over the back of Ralphie's head like a cap.
Mommy!
Ellen wails and attempts to run after her. Cammy Reed pushes away from the pantry door, grabs the little girl around the waist, and drops her back to the floor, just as something that sounds like a monster locust drones across the kitchen, strikes the kitchen faucet, and backflips it like a majorette's baton. Most of the spinning faucet tears through the screen and the spider web on the other side. Water spouts up from what's left, at first almost all the way to the ceiling.
Give him to me!
Pie screams.
Give me my son! Give me my...
Another approaching drone, this one followed by a loud, unmusical clang as one of the copper pots hanging by the stove is hammered into a hulk of twisted fragments and flying shrapnel. And Pi is suddenly just screaming. No words now, just screaming. Her hands are clapped to her face. Blood pours through her fingers and down her neck. Threads of copper litter the front of her misbuttoned blouse. More copper is in her hair, and a large chunk quivers in the center of her forehead, like the blade of a thrown knife.
I can't see!
She shrieks and drops her hands. Of course she can't. Her eyes are gone. So is most of her face. Quills of copper bristle from her cheeks, her lips, her chin.
Help me! I can't see! Help me! David, where are you?
Johnny, lying face down beside Brad in Ellen's room upstairs, can hear her screaming and understands that something terrible has happened. Bullets hem-stitch the air above them. Somewhere on the block, blending hellishly with the sounds of Pie Carver's screams from downstairs, comes the bray of a car alarm, and still the gunfire goes on. As he crawls out into the toy-littered hall, he hears Brad beside him, panting harshly. This has been a hell of an aerobic day for a fellow with such a big stomach, Johnny thinks. But then that thought, the sound of the woman screaming downstairs, and the roar of the gunfire are all driven from his mind.
It's the same guy, he whispers. Oh, Jesus God, it's the same fucking one.
Get down, fool!
Brad grabs his arm and yanks. Johnny collapses forward, not realizing he's been up on his hands and knees, until he comes crashing back down again. Unseen bullets hunt the air over his head. The glass on a framed wedding picture at the head of the stairs shatters. The picture itself falls face down on the carpet with a thump. A second later, the wooden ball atop the banister's newel post disintegrates, spraying a deadly bouquet of splinters. Brad ducks down, covering his face, but Johnny only stares at something on the hallway floor, oblivious of everything else. It's him, Brad. Johnny repeats. He curls his fingers into his hair and gives a brief, hard tug, as if to assure himself that all this is really happening. There's a vicious buzz, almost like a plucked guitar string, over their heads, and the hall light fixture explodes, showering glass down on them. The guy that was driving the blue van, he finishes. The other one shot her, the human, but this is the guy who was driving. He reaches out and picks up one of Ralphie Carver's action figures from the hall floor, which is now littered with glass and splinters as well as toys. It's an alien with a bulging forehead, almond-shaped eyes that are dark and huge, and a mouth that isn't a mouth at all, but a kind of fleshy horn. It's dressed in a greenish, iridescent uniform. The head is bald except for a stiff, blonde strip of hair. "Where's your hat?" he thinks at the little figure, as the bullets whine through the air above him, punching through the wallpaper, shattering the lathes beneath. "Where's your pinned-back cavalry hat, bub?" "What are you talking about?" Brad asks. He's lying full length on his stomach. Now he takes the figure, which is perhaps 7 inches tall, from Johnny and looks at it. Downstairs, the screaming woman falls silent. Brad looks at the alien, then stares at Johnny with eyes that are almost comically round. "You're full of shit." "No," Johnny says, "I'm not. I never forget a face." Brad stares at him a moment longer, then tosses the figure aside and begins wriggling toward the stairwell. Johnny picks it up, looks at it for a moment, then winces as another slug comes through the window at the end of the hall, the one facing the street, and drones directly over his head. He tucks the action figure into the pants pocket not holding the oversized slug and begins to wriggle after Brad. On the lawn of old Doc's house, Peter Jackson stands with his wife in his arms, woundless, at the center of the firestorm. He sees the vans, the shotgun barrels, their muzzles belching fire, and between the silvery one and the red one, he can see Gary Sauderson's old shitbox Saab burning in the driveway. None of it makes much of an impression. He is thinking about how he just got home from work. He thinks he will begin every account of this terrible afternoon by saying, "I just got home from work." This phrase already has become a kind of magical structure inside his head, a bridge back to the sane and orderly world.
"Flaxon!"
The voice makes him sway on his feet. It's as if an alien mouth has opened inside his mind, tearing a hole in it. Mary slips in his aching arms, trying to slither out of his grip, and Peter hugs her tight against him again. At the same time, he comes back to some vague appreciation of reality. Most of the vans are on the move again, but very slowly, still firing. The pink one and the yellow one are now pouring fire into the Reed and Geller residences. One of them, however, is not moving, the black one. It is parked on the other side of the street, blocking most of the Weiler house from view. The turret has slid back, and now a shining figure, all bright gray and dead black, issues from it like a spook. Except, Peter sees, the figure is standing on something. It looks like a floating pillow and seems to be humming. Is it a man? It appears to be wearing a Nazi uniform, all black, glossy fabric and silver rigging, but there is no face above the wings of its collar. Just blackness.
"Jackson, get over here, partner."
When the voice comes again, it isn't like a mouth, but a fishhook, yanking inside his head, tearing his thoughts open.
"Get a move on, pard."
Peter walks across the rain-washed sidewalk, then steps into the gutter. Rushing water fills one shoe, but he doesn't even feel it. In his mind, he is now hearing a very strange thing, a soundtrack being played by a twanging guitar, like an old Duane Eddy instrumental, a tune he knows but can't identify. It is the final maddening touch. The bright figure on the floating pillow descends to street level. As Peter draws closer, he expects to see the black cloth covering the man's face, giving him that spooky look of absence. But he doesn't see it. And as the plate glass window of the Easy Stop explodes down the street, he realizes an awful thing. The man from the black wagon really has no face.
"Oh, God,"
he moans in a voice so low he can barely hear it himself.
"Oh, my God, please."
Two other figures are looking down from the turret of the black van. One is a bearded guy wearing the ruins of what looks like a Civil War uniform. The other is a woman with lank black hair and pale, cruel, beautiful features. Her uniform, like that of the faceless man, is black and silver, Gestapo-ish. Some sort of trumpery gem as big as a pigeon's egg hangs from a chain around her neck, flashing like a remnant of the psychedelic 60s. She's a cartoon, Peter thinks. Some pubescent boy's first hesitant try at a sex fantasy. As he draws closer to the man with no face, he realizes an even more awful thing. He's not really there at all. Neither are the other two. Or the black van. I can see Herbie Wyler's house, he thinks. I can see it right through the van.
Jackson!
But that is real, that voice. Just as the bullet which took Mary's life was real. He screams through a grin of pain, jerking her body closer to his chest for a moment and then dropping her to the street in a tumble without even being aware of it. It is as if someone pressed the end of an electric bullhorn to one of his ears, turned the volume up all the way, and then bellowed his name into it. Blood bursts from his nose and begins to seep from the corners of his eyes.
That-a-way, pard!
The black and silver figure points to the Wyler house. The voice is the only reality, but it is all Peter needs. He jerks his head back so hard his glasses fall askew on his face.
We got us some heroin to do. Biscuit started.
He doesn't walk toward Herbie and Audrey's house. He is pulled toward it, reeled in. As he walks through the black, faceless figure, a crazy image fills his mind for just a moment. Spaghetti, the kind that comes in a can, and hamburger, all mixed together in a white bowl. Just thinking about that kind of food usually nauseates him. But for the moment the image holds in his mind, he is desperately hungry. He lusts for those pallid strands of pasta and that unnatural red sauce. For that moment, even the pain in his head ceases. The twangy guitar is still playing in his head, and as the door to the Wyler house opens all by itself, the guitar is joined by horns, and he places the tune. It's the theme to that old TV show, Bonanza. I just got home from work, he thinks, stepping into a dark, fetid room that smells of sweat and old hamburger. The door slams shut behind him. He's crossing the living room, headed for the arch and the sound of the TV.
What you wearing that uniform for? Someone asks. War's been over near about 3 years, ain't you heard?
I just got home from work, Peter thinks. As if that explained everything. His dead wife, the shooting, the man with no face, the rancid air of this little room. And then, the thing sitting in front of the TV turns around to face him, and Peter thinks nothing at all.